Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and this is going to be a fun discussion. Many of you awoke Tuesday to news and Facebook blowing up and everything over a news conference that announced the publication of a new volume within the Joseph Smith Papers Project, and it's basically a two-volume $90 each, so $180 kind of purchase thing if you were to buy it, of photos and transcription of the printer's manuscript of the Book of Mormon. And so that's kind of neat news and everything, but overshadowing that was the discussion and the release of pictures of a small brown stone that was in Joseph Smith's possession and which has been identified as the main stone that he used when he translated the Book of Mormon. And that has surprised a lot of people who didn't really know about this, or it's made them kind of have to face again, oh yeah, there's this folk religion and this folk magic, and there's all these things that are so pre-Enlightenment type of things going on in the early centuries and the early times of the church, that it's just kind of surprised them and forced a confrontation. So I'd say in my Facebook groups, there's been nothing but the, you know, seer stone for 3 or 4 days. And so what I did is I just got calling good friends and wise heads, and I have Mike Quinn, Ann Taves, and Ron Barney on today's podcast, and each one of them has a neat level of expertise in something related to seer stones and the translation of the Book of Mormon and framing Joseph Smith in these wider ways. So I'm just really excited to have them, and I want to have them introduce themselves right now. In typical Mormon Matters fashion, I want to have Ron Barney introduce himself first to us. Ron was on the podcast a time or two before, and it's always welcome to have you back. So, Ron, I'm going to start prompting you. True or false? Worked at the Church Historical Department for many, many years. How many?
I worked for the church for almost 35 years.
Yeah. And you just recently retired along with your wife as in what role?
Executive directors of the Mormon History Association, and at present I'm the editor of Mormon Historical Studies.
Awesome. And you and I are in a lunch group that's awesome. We've gotten to know each other well over the last 5 or 6 years. And are you open to announcing that you're working on a book about Joseph Smith, or should I cut this part?
Well, I've been plotting away for several years, and interestingly, this particular topic that we're addressing is the one that's kind of keeping me from trying to assume that I know what I'm talking about. I think this is really a very, very important feature of Joseph Smith's life. And while I don't pretend that I or maybe anybody else can actually drill down to the core to explain this to laymen or scholars alike, I think the process, and this is part of the process, I think it's really important.
We're excited to have you on today. You've always had really interesting and good takes about Smith, so I'm going to draw on you big time today. So thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Mike, you're probably the most familiar voice on this podcast to many listeners. Would you share a bit about, take us back to your graduate school and on to teaching at BYU and kind of bring us up to date as what you're doing with projects and things?
Okay. I graduated from BYU as a major in English literature and a minor in philosophy. I got a master's degree in history from the University of Utah. And then I went to Yale University, where I obtained a PhD in history. And I began teaching at BYU a few months after I got my PhD at Yale. And I taught from August 1976 until May 1988, when I chose to leave Brigham Young University. And almost a year before I left, I published a book titled Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, in which I talked at length about Joseph Smith's use of seer stones within the context of a very common pattern of the use of what were called seer stones or peep stones or peak stones in America, particularly in the corridor of New England to New York and Pennsylvania. That was an area in which the use of seer stones was quite common.
So after Early Mormonism, Magic Worldview, you're probably most famous for your two books on the Mormon hierarchy. You have a third volume of that pretty close?
Yes. In early 2016, the third volume, the final volume of the Mormon Hierarchy series will emerge from Signature Books, and its subtitle is Wealth and Corporate Power.
Right.
And it covers the period from 1830 to 2010.
Awesome. And that's, yeah, everyone's dying for that. You've written other books, and you've certainly been known to be, somebody who weighs in with great scholarship and great attention to detail on lots of difficult subjects. And yet you're also known very much as quite a faithful believer in the basic truth claims.
Yeah, I am a, in many ways, I'm a 19th century Mormon believer. I believe
right.
in gold plates and Angel Moroni appearance, and I believe that the Book of Mormon was translated from what I call an Ur text, an original text that is ancient. But the translation in English also included the cultural awareness of Joseph Smith of at his time. And that was the concept that was current about the meaning of translation. The Encyclopedia Britannica said that translation wasn't word for word.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I'm quite a literal believer in the foundational claims of Mormonism.
Awesome. Well, we're grateful to have you on the show. We're just gonna pick your brain left and right, so be ready. Ann Taves, welcome to Mormon Matters for the first time. I've known Ann since 1990, when she was one of my teachers and professors at Claremont, and I'm sure that my dissertation is still fresh in her ears, as her mind is just really outstanding. Wouldn't you say that?
Well, I can certainly remember your dissertation, but maybe not in all the detail that I first encountered it.
Anyway, we had a great time. She was on my committee, and your specialty has always been like history of religions, and especially religion in America, right?
Yeah, I was trained as a historian of Christianity, but with an emphasis in the modern and American contexts.
Right. And I want to talk about some of your publications and interests, but first of all, where are you right now? You're no longer at Claremont. You've been at Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, for how long?
10 years now.
Wow.
I'm in the Department of Religious Studies, at UCSB.
What a wonderful place to live and be. And you hold a chair in Catholic studies. So give us a little bit about your religious background or how it was you came to have an academic chair in Catholic studies.
Well, my religious background is kind of checkered. I was raised in a non-religious home, culturally Protestant, but not practicing anything, and was pretty much of an atheist growing up. Became a Christian in college and wandered in and out of a variety of forms of Christianity, did some Buddhist stuff, and had a stint as a Catholic for a while. And it was during that period, actually, where when I was hired to fill the Catholic Studies chair.
Okay. And then you, one of your first books was on Roman Catholic devotions or something, wasn't it?
Right. My dissertation, which turned into my first book, was called Household of Faith, and it was about Roman Catholic devotional practices in the 19th century. But when I wrote that book, when I picked that topic, it was primarily because those practices seemed so strange to me. Ah. And it was a really large part. I mean, Catholicism is a really large part of American religious history. So to not know much about it seemed to me to be, not a very responsible thing. So that's why I wrote that book. I had Catholic friends in graduate school who did some coaching and stuff like that. But I think you can maybe see in that a pattern of being interested in things that initially seem very puzzling.
Yes, yes. Now, you're also kind of got a good reputation out of a book called Fits, Trances, and Visions, Experiencing Religion and Explaining Experience from Wesley to James. And then I know your Religious Experience Reconsidered book wasn't that super well received. That's probably 5 years ago or so.
Yeah, they were both pretty well received, I would say.
Yeah, and they're playing in this same milieu that we're going to be talking about today, with just people, into different, states of consciousness or whatever it will be that might come into play here. And then I just want to quickly a shout out. Are you able to talk about your new book about revelatory events?
Yeah, it's being reviewed by reviewers at the press right now, and so it should be out from Princeton in the next year or so. And it's called Revelatory Events, as you said, and the subtitle is probably going to be something like Unusual Experiences and the Emergence of New Spiritual Paths. And I'm looking at three case studies, one of which is early Mormonism, and the other two are Alcoholics Anonymous and A Course in Miracles.
Awesome. And with Course of Miracles and a little bit with the AA book, there's sort of a sense of these are received texts from at least the people who wrote them say this wasn't coming from me. This wasn't a product of my mind.
Right. I would say another common feature is all three of the key figures had unusual experiences. But one of the things I find really interesting in the comparison between Alcoholics Anonymous and Mormonism, AAs play down the unusual experiences of Bill Wilson because they wanted AA to be accessible to everybody. And in Mormonism, obviously, they played up the unusual abilities of Joseph Smith relative to everybody else so that he would be the sole prophet.
Oh, very, very cool. Can't wait for the book. Congratulations on that. And again, thanks for coming on More Matters. Just to let everyone know, you've probably, some of you, Anne's been coming to MHA the last few years, and she was at Sunstone this last week. So it was great to see you and have you be part of it. We love having you engage with us.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, you guys, let's just do a quick framing again. So we have this new book that's come out. And it was a neat press conference because in order to get the printer's manuscript and to be able to do this as the Joseph Smith Projects, they had to have the cooperation of the Community of Christ, which is the former Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so Robin Linkhart from the 70, along with Rick Turley from Mormonism, did this wonderful joint conference to say, let's make this available. And then, like I say, the Searstone sort of took discussion. Now, I went and looked at these volumes this morning. They're beautifully done. They're huge, and this spread, basically a left page and a right page facing each other with the color pictures of the seer stone, and it had some text below it, and then a, maybe a 5 or 6 page introductory topic that kind of goes over the history of seer stones, and what about seer stones versus Urim and Thummim, the Nephite interpreters that were supposedly in the box, and things like that. And so it does a pretty straightforward, not you know, no kind of honoring of the shock value that I think a lot of people are feeling and stuff like that. And so I thought, before we kind of talk about the reaction that we're seeing and kind of help to frame it, let's do some history of this particular seer stone, as well as kind of the translation process as we understand it and the various methods that Joseph did. So, Mike, if I can call on you, my memory is that this seer stone, this brown chocolate-covered one that's getting all the attention right now, Joseph Smith found when he was digging a well.
That's correct.
Start us there and kind of tell us the story.
And the well was on the property of a man named Willard Chase, who was a neighbor in Palmyra. And he is the one who provides the exact dating. He dates it to the year 1823. And his account of Joseph Smith finding the stone is the most detailed account we have of its history. He hired, Joseph Smith did odd jobs. He hired out in a variety of capacities. During the farming season, he was sometimes working on the farm, but at other times he was hired out by other people doing other things, and among them was digging. In this case, it was digging a well, and while he was in the process of doing that, he came across this stone. Well, the minute he saw it, according to Willard Chase's report, he regarded it as a very special item, a very special stone. And I didn't really appreciate that until I saw the color photograph of it. It's stunning. It's a beautiful stone. And the white layers or veins in it are not, they don't look random. They look parallel, and it the effect of it is really grabs your attention. And Willard Chase, in his account of the finding of the stone, was very unhappy that Joseph Smith would not return the stone to him. Willard Chase felt that he had the right to it because it was on his property, and with Joseph Smith, it was finders keepers, and possession is nine-tenths of the law, and so that's how it was found.
Now, isn't there some story about Willard's sister being a seer and having a seer stone herself, and Joseph saying, "I want to look in your stone." She lets him, and then he is sort of led to see this stone under the ground, or am I confusing that with a different stone, or is this just a discredited story?
No, it's not a discredited story. It's the story of how he found his first seer stone.
Oh, okay. So it's not this brown one.
It's white, and he obtained that before he obtained the one in 1823.
Okay, so by looking...
It was through her, through Sally Chase, that he was able to find that other stone, which is a white one. And once he used that for purposes of finding things, including looking for buried treasure, but also looking for lost items, he was using that in the Palmyra area prior to 1823, but after he found the chocolate-colored stone in Willard Chase's property while digging the well, he used the brown one exclusively from 1823 until April 1830. And then, according to Mormon accounts, not Willard Chase, in April 1830, he gave the chocolate-colored seer stone to Oliver Cowdery, who was his scribe in the translation of the Book of Mormon. And the provenance of the stone was that it was Oliver Cowdery kept it, and it was in his possession when he died, and of course it went to his widow. Well, Oliver Cowdery's sister had married Phineas H. Young,
right,
who was brother of Brigham Young. And Phineas H. Young visited the Cowdery family and asked the widow of Oliver Cowdery if he could receive the brown chocolate-colored stone. And she gave it to him. And so he brought it back to Salt Lake City, and it went into the possession of his brother, the president of the church in Utah, Brigham Young. And the next time it prominently surfaces in Mormon records is 1888. So it's a long period of time, 30 years, before it becomes a public item again, or basically public. And at that point, Brigham Young was long dead. And Wilford Woodruff, as president of the church, had custody of it at that point. And he brought it to the dedication ceremony of the Manti Temple in 1888. And he, in a ceremony of dedication prayer for the stone itself, he had a prayer and a consecration of this seer stone during the ceremonies connected with the dedication of the Manti Temple in 1888. After that point, there were many people who saw it at that point. But after that point, members of the First Presidency did not display it in any public way, even in a temple where there would be a limited number of people looking at it. And visitors to the First Presidency's office on an individual basis were allowed to see it. Some of them were descendants of Brigham Young, who was instrumental in bringing it to the possession of the First Presidency. Others were just people who came to the First Presidency's office back in the day, 100 and some odd years ago, when you could walk in with no problem because it was a relatively small church, and they just knew about the stone, and they asked if they could see it, and if the president of the church was in the right mood, he would say, of course. And so there were just rank-and-file members who, without any forewarning, came in and asked to see it, and they were allowed to see it. But this was on a very limited basis. I've only heard of less than six accounts. My guess is there would be maybe a dozen or so people who saw it in the First Presidency's office in this way after 1888.
And then it just eventually just that stopped happening, and it ended up in the vault. And as far as we know, it's really never been talked about much or anything since.
Well, no, and it was in the vaults. It was in the safe of the First Presidency from Brigham Young onward. But you know, the farther people were as members of devout members of the church from the dedication of the Manti Temple, where a number of people were aware of the seer stone because of Wilford Woodruff making it this kind of public or semi-public display of it. As time passed, fewer and fewer members of the church knew about it,
right,
and so fewer and fewer people made any requests to see it. And so it was only those who generally were descendants of Brigham Young or Phineas Young who had a family connection to the acquisition of it, or it was people who had read enough about the early documents of the 19th century church who knew that there was such a stone and that it had eventually gone to the First Presidency, who in the 1970s made a request to see it. And one of those I know was Zina Firmage, who was a daughter of the first presidency counselor, Hugh B. Brown, but more significantly, she was a direct descendant of Brigham Young. And so she requested the opportunity to see it, and I got a letter from her where she gave her description of the time when she was shown it. But again, my guess is that there were only about a dozen people who did see it, and she handled it, and that's usually what happened. They were not only shown it, they were given the opportunity to handle it. But it was a very small group of people from 1888 to the present.
Okay, great. Thank you. Anne or Ron, anything on this stone that you'd want to bring up at this point?
I just want to pose the question, do you suppose, Mike, that the reason that it was held back, the reason there was little or no discussion about it was the culture had changed in such a dramatic way that the thoughts about it, rather than it being something of a specially sacred nature, there was maybe a little bit of a consternation about how do we explain this?
I think that was part of it. But very early on, you can demonstrate from early Mormon documents that after 1830, the seer stone was also called the Urim and Thummim. And that confused this brown seer stone, a single item, with what was described as the Book of Mormon's Urim and Thummim and the Hebrew Bible's Urim and Thummim, which was two stones in a breastplate, in a kind of ornate manner of being held within that breastplate. And the clearest evidence of the interchangeability of that occurred in 1842 in two diaries, one by Brigham Young and one by Wilford Woodruff. And they both, on the same date, said that Joseph Smith showed the means by which he was currently working on translation of not only the papyrus of Egypt that he had received in 1835 in Kirtland, but he was also working on what was called an Egyptian grammar, and Brigham Young said that he showed them the seer stone that he was using for that, and Wilford Woodruff said he showed them the Urim and Thummim. And so it's very clear in that instance, in that event, that members of the church were at a reasonably early period using the term Urim and Thummim, which prior to the 1830s had a very different reference to a very different appearing object, and they were using that term to apply to the single ovular stone that we now have a picture of courtesy of the first presidency. And I think because that confusion of using the same term, Urim and Thummim, for two very different appearing objects is a reason that it goes beyond the question of folk magic, which is a part of that environment of the 1820s and even earlier centuries before. But it was also a question of trying to explain to members of the church that a term, Urim and Thummim, had been applied in a different way after 1830 than it was in the familiar Mormon scriptures, including the Bible, prior to that time. And I think that's really the more, in my view, the more salient reason why there was a reluctance to publicize this, because it required explaining that change of term from seer stone to Urim and Thummim.
Yeah, so let's clarify here. With the plates, was supposedly in the box, the story is that there was sometimes they're called the Nephite spectacles, right? These two stones that are in some kind of frame, perhaps attached to the breastplate, perhaps detachable, sort of Laban and things like that. And so that's what I think most members of the church are thinking that Joseph Smith used to translate the Book of Mormon. When in reality, what were those used for, and when did they fall out of either Joseph Smith's use or favor? And then from that point on, he did mostly use this brown stone. So will you tell us that story? And jump in with any... Did you have any question that beyond where we're at in the conversation right now?
I guess I would just maybe pause the conversation a minute here and talk a little bit about the earliest sources we have and what terms they're using. Because I think you're right in terms of what Mormons today think was recovered and when, but if we look at the earliest, at least the earliest source I found was Jesse Smith's letter to Hiram in 1829 that refers to Joseph's spectacles that he used to decipher hieroglyphics. And then there's an 1830 reference from Peter in an interview with Peter Bauer where he apparently told the newspaper reporter that he translated the characters with the aid of a glass, which he obtained with the plate. And then the Book of Mormon uses two terms. So in Mosiah, we have interpreters that are used to translate plates. And in Alma 37, we have in the original version the word directors referring to stones that are used to translate, which later editions of the Book of Mormon changed to the word interpreters. So we've got a lot of terminology here. And this is all terminology that was used before we get Urim and Thummim in the 30s. So I think there's a lot of potential for confusion here, and I just wanted to introduce a little bit more.
Oh, nice. More confusion, yay! No, that's great stuff, because, yeah, that was my understanding is, you know, it was pretty late before somebody said, hey, I wonder if these stones could be like the Urim and Thummim, and they kind of just seemed like, oh, that was nice. That's a good way to frame, you know, through biblical term, Urim and Thummim, what these seer stones were. And so that all came pretty late. I don't think Joseph Smith, right from the start, was calling his stones a Urim and Thummim.
If I recall, it was W.W. Phelps in 1833 that made the designation or the relationship of Urim and Thummim to what Joseph Smith had used, if I remember right.
Yeah, that's what I've read too.
Thank you. So let's quickly tell the story of the translation of the Book of Mormon. So Mike, when Joseph Smith first begins, he translates the Book of Lehi, which you know we know as the 116 pages. It's the part that Martin Harris took the transcription off, showed it, lost it, and all that kind of stuff. And now we don't have that anymore in the Book of Mormon. Am I right in remembering that at least that Joseph Smith seemed to use the Nephite interpreters for that initial run when he produced the 116 pages?
No, I don't think so.
That's not the scholarly consensus. Okay, then I'm...
Well, it's not my understanding. Okay. My understanding, again, part of this is because so much of the narrative of that early period isn't committed to writing until the 1830s. The most available detailed account isn't written until 1838. And in the accounts that my understanding are that he returned the plates, he returned the contents of the box, was more than the plates, to Moroni, and that that was included, what was that by the 1838 account is included the term Urim and Thummim. And that went to Moroni the angel. My understanding is that in the, in my memory, and I'm going by memory on this, I don't have the documents in front of me, that when Martin Harris talked about the translation process that he was involved in 1828, he referred to a singular object as being the object with which Joseph Smith used the, or, you know, translated that early portion, which was lost, the 116 handwritten pages by Martin Harris as the scribe. And so I don't think that the whether you call them directors or you call them interpreters, the dual object item or the dual stone item was used at any point in the translation. That's my understanding, that it was not in use in 1828.
Okay, that's not what I've picked up, at least from things I've read over the last few days. Ron or Anne, is there anything more than that? Because I've also heard that, you know, sometimes some of the witnesses said he put the spectacles in the bottom of a hat, so there was like some confusion about whether there was one stone or two stones in the bottom of the hat. What have you guys picked up on the terms? Because I guess the reason I even kind of went down that, Mike, is there seemed to be, you know, Joseph receives the chastisement for the 116 pages, and when the plates are returned to him, there seems to be some accounts that he no longer had access to the spectacles at that point.
That's
where he had to go to the chocolate stone as his means.
Right. But if I remember the accounts that we have, and I think they're limited, of Martin Harris either telling someone directly in an interview or somebody repeating what he said to them, I think that he still uses the, when he makes it any kind of physical description, he's talking about a translation with a hat. But I could be mistaken, because it's been a long time since I've read those, and I didn't review those early accounts of that 1828 translation. But after he was responsible for the loss of that English translation of 116 pages, the accounts are all in agreement that Joseph Smith was severely chastised, and as a punishment he was deprived of the gold plates and all the other artifacts for a period of time. And then when he began the translation process, where Oliver Cowdery was the scribe a year later in the spring and summer of 1829, that at that point the accounts all agreed that it was a single stone in a hat that he used. And the most detailed account of that is by David Whitmer, who observed the translation process in the home, the Whitmer home, and said that it was with a single brown stone in a hat. I could be mistaken. And Ron, you may be able to correct me on this, about the accounts by Martin Harris about the 1828 effort.
Well, Harris's language for it comes, as I recall, from Tiffany's magazine in late 1850s, and I'm trying to remember a particular, if he actually, he does describe the stone in the hat, but I don't recollect his description of the stone. As you state, David Whitmer's he's the guy who talks about it most. He's the most prolific explainer and describer of the translation, and it's because that the latter part of it took place, as you say, in his home. So I've kind of concluded that there was nothing authoritative written about, or even an attempt to describe the process of that first venture with the plates. At least nothing survives, and I don't see any attempt to try to have done that, which also suggests it was perhaps something less than consequential to those who were interested.
Well, when I said that Martin Harris gave a description, I don't mean that he described the color or anything on that order. My understanding of my memory, anyway, was that in his description that we have, and it's always second hand because it's somebody reporting what he told to them, whether it's a newspaper reporting an interview or someone else, that he simply said that it was a stone in a hat. That was my memory, that he did not describe it as being the Urim and Thummim. He did not describe it as being two stones. But again, I have not read those documents by him for a very long time, or that relate to his experience, the 1828 experience. So I can't be certain about what I'm remembering.
I would actually agree with both Mike and Ron that we don't have any very good evidence to suggest that he was using, you know, something other than the stone in the early period. I mean, so it's conjectural also to say he was using the stone, but I think personally, I think that's the most likely. I think that there's a lot of confusion in the sources as to what happened after he was chastised too. So I would raise some questions about the narrative that you were just giving about post-chastisement, because I think everybody agrees that something was lost and then returned somewhat later, but what was lost and what was returned and when it was returned seems to differ a lot in the sources. And the best real-time source we have is DNC 3, which, as I read it, seems to suggest that what was lost was his ability to translate. Because, and this mention of him trampling on his directors, which actually, come to think of it, if directors is a reference to Alma, then it's probably a reference to his seer stone. So personally, I think it's more likely that he's being chastised for trampling on his director, whatever exactly that means, and may have lost the ability to see in his seer stone. But others, of course, later say he lost the plates or he lost his interpreters, but they can't agree on what he lost or when it was returned. And LDS interpreters or historians have been struggling to reconcile the evidence to come up with a coherent narrative, I think.
Right, and of course what you're referring to a gift or ability to translate.
Yes.
An internal ability on the part of a spiritual ability that was taken, whereas other accounts refer to an object as the gift that was allowed the translation. And this is complicated by the fact that in that early environment, people generally, totally outside of Mormonism, regarded objects like peak stones or peep stones or seer stones, as they were called, or a glass, as having power in itself, but not everyone could access that power. And so that some people had the relatively rare gift to pick up a stone or glass or peak stone, whatever one would call it, and had that gift to energize that object for revelatory purpose. So The gift is both an object that has power in itself, but also there's a gift within the individual who uses that object.
Yeah, I would generally agree with that account of things. I would nuance it a little bit. I think you're absolutely right to insert the word gift. That's certainly how DNC 3 and how Smith and, you know, his immediate family seem to view it, although not his more extended family. I think you're probably right that at the time, a lot of people believed that the power could be in the stone as well as a gift that the seer had. I think if we want to talk about how it might have worked from a more contemporary perspective or a naturalistic perspective, we can talk about that as well. But I think you're right that at the time, many people believed that the power was both in the stone and in the human being.
Right.
The gift.
You mentioned the letter of Jesse Smith to his brother, Joseph Smith Sr. And the important thing to remember about him is that Jesse was not on the scene to actually observe any of these objects or artifacts. He was writing angrily about what he had been told about the Book of Mormon. And so when he refers to the rod and he refers to the directors or the interpreters, he's commenting about something he's been told. He's not commenting about something he has observed.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And Jesse Smith is certainly a hostile interpreter. But to me, the important thing about that is that the source, he's alluding to a letter that he has received from Joseph himself earlier. And this is one of our earliest sources. So the fact that he's even mentioning spectacles,
right?
That's what I think is significant.
As long as we're talking about sources, I think there's one that's quite telling, even though it was not about a description per se of the translation process, and that is the account that has been attributed to Joseph Knight, written sometime from the mid-30s to the mid-40s. I don't think anybody's nailed that down yet, but Joseph Knight said that he was, if this really is a representation of his first person account, he said he was there when Joseph returned from the hill. And it wasn't the plates, he said, that excited Joseph. It was these glasses, mm-hmm. in which he said, "I can see anything." And I've wondered if, and it's entirely speculative, but it plays into a little bit of the idea of Joseph retiring the use of the stone after the translation of the Book of Mormon, or at least the Brown Stone. If there may have been some other purpose for the stone besides just the Book of Mormon. He was tied to what later is described, you know, the description of, or the definition of a seer in the Book of Mosiah. At any rate, what I'm saying is that one of the earliest and maybe most important sources of reflecting what might have been the circumstance of Joseph's use of those was his ability to see rather than his ability to interpret or translate, although they may indeed have been synonyms with that word.
Oh, well, another piece of evidence that would fit with what you're talking about is comes from Chase's account, which is later, but when Chase found the stone, he said that it was singularly appearing, but he said that when Joseph put it into his hat and then his face on top of the hat, he alleged that he could see in it. So you get another reference to the seeing that I think is really important. So I agree with you on that.
Well, and in agreement also with Ron about the brownstone having a purpose other than the Book of Mormon is the fact that the accounts, many of them hostile by neighbors, refer to Joseph Smith after 1823 using his seer stone for looking for treasure. And then, aside from those generally hostile, although in some cases there are believer accounts of that, but the early revelations that were given to Joseph Smith or that he dictated prior to April 1830 often are described as being that he received them through the Urim and Thummim, or he received them through the seer stone. So the seer stone was a source of revelation, whether it was to find things or to translate things or to give a current revelation for current needs of the church and of those believers.
Yeah, and one other document that I think is really important, the 1826 trial.
Yeah.
When Joseph is brought into court because the nephew of Josiah Stoll, who he's been helping to search for treasure, is worried about what his uncle's doing. And the testimony in that, I think, is really interesting because it shows the range of views of what people thought that Joseph and or the seer stone, you know, was possible with either one of those. And
right.
So there were some people that were hugely skeptical and thought it was all totally bogus, and others who were totally convinced that he had special abilities and that the stone had special abilities.
Right. But again, when they were talking about what he was using, it was always a singular stone.
Right, and the stone in the hat.
Right.
Good stuff. I am I'm worried that we're going to get a little bit too lost in all of this and kind of lose touch with the story as taught in Mormonism. And so let me at least pull us back to that. So I think the average member of the church who had never heard of seer stone at all, you know, kind of grew up with the narrative, and there's certainly the images, the pictures that have been produced, whatever. I'm not sure general authority approval on them, or, you know, any church historians ever looked at these pictures before they went out. But the idea is that most people think somehow or other, whatever he used was a clear object that could sort of shine or could be translucent or something. And they figured it was like this mechanical process of Joseph Smith consulting this in some way. And it seems to be the most common thing, and it seems the church is doubling down a little bit on this one theory, is that somehow words in English would appear on the stone. And so when they're seeing this brown stone that doesn't have any clear section to it or something like that, they're having to really confront here, what was the translation process like? So what evidence, or what are the different competing theories about what happened when his head was in the hat? Who wants to try that? I know, Anne, this is kind of starting to move into the area of what you're going to be producing in your next book. But Mike, do you want to? Who wants to start?
We can let Mike go, or I can try and I can summarize what I've gleaned from reading all the LDS guys I could find on this. Either way, yeah.
I don't like the idea of automatic translation, although that is certainly what David Whitmer claimed.
Right.
He claimed that Joseph Smith saw words on the stone.
And that does seem to be what the church is saying now.
And they followed that line. However, right. the only revelatory description of the process does not describe it as automatic. And that's when Oliver Cowdery tries to translate. And the revelation that is given to Oliver Cowdery in 1829 shows that it is not automatic and does not appear as obviously as a set of words, but that instead, that if he wanted to translate, he had to ponder it, and then it would be a revelatory process that would be a cause of burning in his bosom, is the phrase that is used in the revelation, that he would know what the words were. And that is very clearly not, you know, looking at something and seeing a line of English words.
Right.
And that's the form of revelation and translation that I'm most comfortable with, particularly in view of the fact that there is so much misspelling in the the scribal scraps that we have in Oliver Cowdery's handwriting of those of what Joseph Smith was dictating to him. I think this kind of search it out in your mind and your heart, and God will reveal to you inwardly that these words or phrases are the correct translation. To me, that is the only revelatory description that we have, and I regard David Whitmer's description of words appearing as his interpretation of what Joseph Smith was doing.
Can I just interject here and
pose a quiz to you, Mike, and or Ann? Is it the case, and if you look at the article that is going to come out, which is available online, the article that is going to come out in the Ensign in October about what the church is doing with the Joseph Smith papers, and it also with the accompanying photographs, there is an attempt to try to make the circumstance comply with our modern perceptions about what translation is, or that there was nothing that Joseph really intuited from this, but rather somebody was doing something externally for him, and he just became in some ways, the middleman, the guy who transferred the information to Oliver Cowdery. If you can tell what I'm trying to say,
I do not regard prophets as God's puppets. I just don't.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is, it makes it so that it seems to be more compatible with the physicality, the materiality, the tactile transfer of heavenly information via something that is explainable in our vernacular, rather than what I think you're suggesting is that something that would be more revelatory in at least how we would define that. That didn't make any sense at all, I realize, but
I know what
I was saying.
Yeah.
Well, Joseph did not understand ancient languages. The only ancient language he studied was Hebrew and Greek, but mainly Hebrew. And what Reformed Egyptian, whatever it is, was not part of his training. He couldn't have read it on his own.
Well, and he wasn't looking at the plates either.
No, and that's true. That's the other popular misconception, that this stone and its description in the official account has raised, is that most of these modern paintings of the translation process show Joseph Smith looking down at a set of gold plates,
right,
very often with several of them already being turned, as though he's in the process of reading through the narrative that is contained on those records. That's not how all the witnesses who make a description of the process say he dictated the words. He dictated the words while peering in a hat in which the stone, or stones, but usually it's a singular stone, was. And so he was uttering a translation to Oliver Cowdery independent of any gold plates.
And do you want to move a little bit into some of the areas of from your chapter that you pre-circulated to us about what, you know, what seems to be, you said, here's my theory. Here's some conclusions that I think I can draw from, you know, comparing Joseph Smith to the woman who did, how do you say her last name?
Shookman. Helen Shookman.
Who did Course in Miracles, and Bill, Mr. What's his last name again? Bill Wilson.
Yeah, Bill Wilson didn't do anything
comparable, right,
really.
But you had some really interesting things here that I think fits a little bit with Mike says, in the sense of what was happening in somehow Joseph Smith got himself into an interpretive or a flow kind of mindset when he's had his head in the hat.
Yeah. But let me just say that, let me go back to the kinds of evidence that we have, because one kind of evidence that we have is from the scribes and other people who were witnessing the process. And obviously, they can't get directly into Joseph's mind. So they're just observing what he's doing, and his ability to stop and start the translation, and also the fact that he is dictating it very fluidly most of the time, but occasionally he will stop and be puzzled and spell words.
Right.
And so as I read the different LDS people, or, you know, scholars who've tried to figure this out, and Mike is one of them, I see these competing theories, but I think it's possible that these theories are drawing from different bits of the evidence and trying to form it into one picture. And part of what I realized from comparing him to Helen Shookman is that it may have been, he might have been able to do both. In other words, he may have most of the time had a flow of words that he was perceiving in some way and dictating them, and at points where he became puzzled, that he could, in effect, ask to see a word and then spell it out. It would be a lot to kind of spell out all the evidence for that, but one thing that I would highlight is that in addition to these people watching Smith, the source that I think is even better than the one that Mike was referring to, which is, he was talking about DNC 9, which was addressed to Oliver Cowdery. So some people have raised questions about whether Joseph was also expected to think it out in his mind, or if that was primarily addressed to Oliver Cowdery. But the revelation just before that, DNC 8, talks, I think, about the revelatory process more generally. And it says, and it is still addressed to Cowdery, but I think speaking more generally, that he would receive a knowledge of whatever things, and here I'm putting it into regular English, he would ask for with an honest heart, believing that he shall receive, including a knowledge concerning the engravings of the old records, referring to the plates, And then the revelation continues, I will tell you in your mind and in your heart by the Holy Ghost, which shall come upon you and which shall dwell in your heart. Now behold, this is the spirit of revelation. I think that is our best real-time evidence of what the process was like. And that's either, you know, if you're an LDS believer, the voice of the Lord explaining what the Holy Spirit is going to do, or if you're, you know, a naturalistic type person like myself, you know, this is some deep unconscious part of Smith's mind telling us what it was like.
I agree. I think that, again, this is the only revelatory description that we have. And it indicates both in both revelations that we have that the spirit of revelation, as it's called, or the gift of revelation that was involved in the Book of Mormon was an inward gift. It was an inward experience, not something visual.
Well, I'm with you on there, and that's how I prefer it. But the church seems to be going with this more mechanical thing. So is now the time to talk about our reaction to why they might be by wanting to privilege, you know, written language glowing on a stone or whatever? They're certainly not doing anything to stop people from visualizing that as what happened. Go ahead.
Before you do that, Dan, could I just interject something here?
Please.
We've made the assumptions, and I don't know if it's been just based on the Old Testament model of God telling a man what to do, and therefore we have this vertical image that revelation comes from God to man. So it's A to B, or 1 to 2, or some type of equation like that. I think there are a number of things in the revelations indicating there's something beyond that, where an inspired, and you could say, well, inspired would suggest that he's getting some tutorial from God. But I think there's something beyond that in the revelations. There's two in 1830. There's three in 1831. And there's a very explicitly stated one in 1842 that later is canonized, where Joseph is suggesting that there is something inside of a man, if he's a righteous man, and if he has the imprimatur of God upon him, not necessarily the mind of God on him, but at least that he's doing things for these righteous purposes, that what he does will be sanctioned by God. In other words, that his words become revelation, his words become authentic, and that heaven will then sustain the things that are conjured by this man. I don't have time to explain it all here, but it very clearly this, in my judgment, that there's abundant information suggesting that what Joseph Smith is getting, that we call revelation, is only one aspect of what his role was as a prophet.
Well, I think Joseph had an odd concept, and the fact that he revised revelations, not going beyond the Book of Mormon, but the revelations that we know as the Doctrine and Covenants, he revised them significantly during his lifetime. And that, to me, is evidence that he regarded the textual words as fluid.
Right.
Yeah, I guess I agree with that. I would put it that he believed in a process of continuing revelation that
right.
allowed the later the later revisings to be just as authentic in terms of revelation as the earlier ones, I guess.
Right, which suggests that he didn't think that what was happening was he was getting the exact words that God wanted on the page. In other words, he wasn't seeing words in the thing, because then you would sense that he would privilege those, you know, as having come through this miraculous process. Whereas the way he understood himself and what was happening, it was more in this conceptual way. And if I'm feeling inspired that this is a more accurate way, I'm going to change it.
Well, let me just see if I can defend the seeing words
or
the other view a little bit more. I mean, I think the fact that we were talking about him being able to see or claiming to see things in the seer stone suggests that he's a visual person. He's a visualizer. And so I interpret him, you know, there's some people that hear the word of God, and I think he leans toward the visual side. And so when these things are being told to him in his mind and in his heart by the Holy Ghost, I don't think that's incompatible with him feeling as if he's seeing the words, but in a kind of, in the sense that they kind of come to him, maybe not quite as literal a sense as people would envision, you know, words flowing across the seer stone.
Right, ticker, yeah, one of those tickers. Yeah,
like a ticker, exactly. But I do think that he tended to use visual language an awful lot of the time, and I think we might want to take that into account.
Well, I agree fundamentally with Van on that, in that even though I tend to privilege the descriptions of burning within your breast and God will tell you in your heart and your soul, the whole meaning of seer is a one who sees.
Right.
And he clearly took upon himself the term seer. He was very definite about the fact that he saw things, not just visions of angels and God, but beyond that. So I both have to be in as a part of his concept of what revelation and his concept of what translation was.
So what do you think's going on inside that hat? You know, he's got his face there. The blocking out the light tends to make people want to say that that's to better see something that's illuminated there. Or do you guys think that he's more, he's got his head in the hat, and somehow or other it just helps him to have that stone there to kind of move into a flow state? I know, Anne, and this is some material that I think you really have done a great job in that chapter from your forthcoming book. Do you want to kind of, I know you can't do it all, but can you at least give a sense of what your thinking's happening there?
Yeah. When I analyzed Helen Schuckman, who also produced a very complicated text that she claimed she was not the author of, but she claimed that, in at least the popular way we hear it, she claimed that she heard a voice, the voice of Jesus. But in an interview, she gave a much more detailed description with a very probing interviewer. And she was a psychologist, an academic psychologist. And she backed off of the term hearing and said it really wasn't like hearing, and it was hard, and it wasn't an external voice, and it was much harder to describe than that. And she said, I think maybe I'm using the wrong word when I say hear. I sort of recognized it. It was very rapid. I knew that was the word. I think knew might be K-N-E-W. Might be a better word than heard. And her backing off of hearing in that way struck me as a way that we could think about Joseph Smith in relation to seeing, and especially to link that to the idea of the Holy Spirit putting things in his mind and in his heart. So it struck me that both might have been, in effect, having a sense of knowing what the words were, that the words were coming into their mind most of the time as a sort of flow of words that they knew, as, you know, that they picked up as words and then were able to dictate, or in Shookman's case, to write in very quick shorthand.
Right. And the second step of that, the flow, is then to somehow have quieted that part of them that is sort of, you called it the executive, wasn't the executive ego, but it was quieting that editing part of our rational minds, and it was just sort of letting this go kind of with confidence.
Yeah, that's the other part that is, you know, I find really interesting to try and explain, which is, why did they feel that the words weren't theirs? And and I think that there's a lot of interesting comparisons we can make. I mean, there are some novelists who report their characters seeming to come to life and, you know, telling their story, and the authors still saying it's a novel, but not feeling like they wrote it exactly. But there's also evidence with some people who are easily hypnotized. And there's one that I used in my comparison because he was a really good storyteller, and he told a story to a group of students about being in, I think it was Queen Victoria's court. And, you know, so it sounded like a past life. And they all believed it. He convinced himself. And so he went to the Hypnosis Research Center at Stanford to ask the researchers there to investigate and tell him what was going on with him. And so they had him recount stories both under hypnosis and just in a regular fashion. And under hypnosis, he told the stories in a way that his storytelling self didn't know what was going to happen next, but that the researchers were able to ask to get in touch with another part of himself that was split off, that was actually planning the story.
Oh, and so, great. That's a great, great example.
Yeah, and it suggests, and the way that they're now talking about hypnosis, at least in some subjects, it doesn't require that a person who's highly hypnotizable go into a deep trance. It the way they're talking about it now is it involves shifts in attention and cognitive control processes. So that some people apparently have a really unusual ability to manipulate these things. And so in this case, perhaps to split off the part of themselves that is planning the narrative from the part of themselves that is telling or recounting the narrative as it comes to them.
That's
fascinating. Yeah. Now, and from reading your chapter, I quickly remembered a section from a podcast I did with Richard Bushman, who is a Mormon patriarch. And there's this idea of being, you know, in a patriarch, that you're giving these blessings that are, you know, you're giving voice to, you know, the spirit's, you know, information about this person. And and so I got him to kind of said, what's going on in your head and in your mind here? And he told the story of how in this podcast, and I'll link to it, and it's about 25 minutes in, he says that when he was early on in these blessings, things would come to his mind, and then he would say something to, like, to himself. He goes, ooh, I need to be careful about that. And so he would sort of soften the language and kind of be more vague than these words that came into his head. And he says that at this gathering of patriarchs, a general authority came, and he says, the brethren, and he said that the person said it with great, you know, enthusiasm, with great, you know, passion. He says, what you are charged to do is give voice to the spirit of prophecy. And so what he said for that, he says, my job is not to give a sensible blessing that would wear through time, but to hearken to the Spirit that came to me and to just speak boldly words that come to my mind. And from that point on, that's what he tried to do. And so it kind of reminded me of a little bit about some of the things in here that where you kind of just simply said that, you know, with the person under his hands, he puts himself in a spot where he learns to just say what flows. And I don't know, there was just something in there that kind of reminded me that maybe is sort of what's going on with Joseph Smith and Helen Schuchman or something like that, where they're no longer, once they kind of find that channel or find that little, flip the switch, and like you say, they can still kind of act normal and stuff like that, but they kind of know where this channel is, and then they just turn off that executive, editing kind of voice.
Yeah, I think that you're right on target here, and it's been interesting to me as I've tried parts of this chapter out on LDS folks who do engage in blessings, giving blessings, or otherwise, you know, sense of being receiving personal revelation, that they've been saying things like that. And Kathleen Flake, for example, gave me the phrase that I put here. They might have had a sense of meaning so immediate as to feel as if it were a word. And as, you know, a practicing Mormon, I figure Kathleen was drawing on some experience in helping me to reformulate that point there. But I've also, like you said, had a couple of people who do give blessings talk about it like Richard was. And I would suggest that the ritual context, maybe the point of putting their hand on the person's head to bless them, is what, you know, initiates a shift to this other mode, in the same way that I suspect that putting his head in the hat, looking at the stone, triggered a shift for Joseph, and that picking up her scribe notebook triggered a shift for Helen Schuchman.
Right.
That's a brilliant analysis. That's wonderful.
Oh, thanks.
I had not thought of it in those terms, despite thinking about these things for decades. To me, a revelation. I really appreciate that.
You know, Anna and I have been talking about this kind of stuff for years. I remember introducing you to William Moraine's book, The Sword of Laban, and kind of getting you sort of at least alerted to how I feel in some ways that Joseph Smith's early life kind of led him to become this in and out of normal consciousness as kind of a normal thing. And you know, some of it triggered by his surgery and the ability to dissociate from the pain and during that long recovery process and stuff like that. I kind of get a sense that Joseph Smith, a lot like children who train in shamanism around the world, are often sickly or injured children who learn in some ways to manipulate consciousness or to have, you know, these shifts of things, and then they get kind of comfortable with it, and it becomes sort of a second nature and something in their tool bag that serves them well. But when they become shaman, I kind of get a sense that Joseph Smith just had those abilities, and perhaps it came purely from the trauma of his leg surgery, you know, though I'm not insisting on that as the only possibility.
Just a note on that, Dan, there are a lot of people who have taken a close look at what Moraine and Anderson have said about the early experiences of Joseph having influence later on, especially
the text of the Book of Mormon,
writing the Book of Mormon. And I think that, just to make a statement, there are a lot of people who are very, very open to the kinds of things that Anne has been saying, and but who have a real hard time with the Moraine Anderson argument, because those men are coming in not just because they're coming from a different discipline, but there is so much that is mixed up in the minutiae of early Mormonism, of which Mike would be exceptionally familiar, that sometimes it's difficult for someone coming in, someone who is on the, say, the inside of Mormonism, to try to understand this, someone steeped in early Mormonism, to be able to understand how someone can come in from the outside who is who's taking a look at this. And I'm not saying they shouldn't or can't or whatever, but it's sometimes very difficult for some of us to be able to see those kinds of things because they are not crafted in the context of the complexity of the Mormonism of which we are aware.
Well, right. in this case, I'm certainly not claiming the Book of Mormon as psychobiography the way those guys are. I'm just, you know, from my own religious studies background, and especially I did a lot on ritual and those kinds of things when I was in my master's thesis. There's definitely an ability that I think some people, based upon illness, based upon pain and things like that, that can develop as sort of a talent that I think may have picked up there. The rest of it, I'm not a big fan of all that they did with that either.
Well, there's one thing that we all are struggling, maybe like blind men and the elephant, to interpret those shreds of evidence that have existed and persisted that we can examine. But I think there's also a side that people who share an experience often understand it totally differently. And the biblical example I think of is, and I forget which gospel it's in, but the voice of God speaks to Jesus as my beloved son. And some of the people nearby hear something. They don't hear words. They hear something and they think it's thunder. And other people on the scene hear nothing. And they're all witnesses. They're all there when this experience, a metaphysical experience occurs. And that's in terms of, an auditory metaphysical experience. In terms of visionary metaphysical experience, I think of what Mormons revere as Section 76, where two men, Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon, have this extended visionary sight of the afterlife. And yet they are in a group of men, none of whom share that vision. Mm-hmm. And so, it's not simply us a long distance away trying to interpret shreds of evidence. Even people who experience the same space and time as a seer or a hearer of something metaphysical experience it differently or don't experience it at all.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I mean, in terms of, that's why I think that 1826 trial is such a nice document, because it just captures those points of view.
Yeah.
But the next trial that I'm aware of, where Lucy Harris brought Smith into court in Lyons, is another instance. We don't have as good a transcript of it as I recall, but it's another instance where you get this outrageously different testimony from the skeptics and the believers, and it's dismissed because Lucy Harris's husband believes that the plates are real and that Joseph Smith is not trying to defraud him.
Right. And that's like Stoll in 1826.
Exactly.
Yeah, the guy who brings it forward as he's doing this to my uncle. Was it his uncle or his father?
It was his uncle.
Yeah, his uncle. And then the uncle comes and goes, nope, that's not how I'm seeing it. So,
but Dan, to go back to the injury and all that, I've puzzled over that some. And you know, there's a tendency with to talk about dissociation in conjunction with what used to be called multiple personality,
right,
and child sexual abuse. And I don't want to say that that doesn't happen. It certainly does happen, I think, but not everyone who suffers in that way uses that kind of strategy to deal with it. And there's a lot of instances around the world of visionary type figures and shamanistic type figures and whatever who may not
didn't have that childhood experience. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that we have to be careful, and
sure,
I think we can look to a variety of contexts in which he could have developed his visionary abilities. And sure, maybe, you know, when he was recovering from the surgery, he used visualization of some sort to help him get through that. We don't have any evidence of it as far as I know, but, you know, that's certainly possible.
Yeah, let's not worry about that little sidebar that I took us down so much.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.